This week on Art in the Air features our interview with the newly appointed Executive Director for the Indiana Arts Commission, Maya Michelson. Next, we discover the cultural heritage of Columbus, Indiana with Richard McCoy, Executive Director of the Landmark Columbus Foundation. Our spotlight is on Lebesnik's Holiday Artisan Market opening November 20th, running through January 9th with Rose Tejeda.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. We'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight Rose Tejeda. She's the manager of the gift shop at Lebesnik Center for the Arts in Michigan City, and she's going to tell us about some exciting things coming up, but also tell a little bit about herself and about the whole gift shop. So, Rose, welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Aloha, Rose. Thank you very much. Hi. Well, Lebesnik Center for the Arts does have a gift shop, which many people may not realize, and it's a really wonderful little space where we bring in artists to bring their wares. So we have everything from jewelry to pottery to two-dimensional art, all kinds of things, all very creative and handmade by local and regional artists. It's the perfect place to pick up a gift.
So tell us a little bit, just briefly, about yourself, your background, where you grew up, where you went to school, and, you know, and then we'll go on to more of the gift shop.
Sure. I was born and raised here in Michigan City, and I have to proudly say that I am a Red Devil graduate of Elston High School. I went to IU after I graduated from high school, and I got a BA in interior design. And my career has been in Chicago for about 30 years. My specialty is retail design. So in that line of work, I developed prototype concepts for new retailers and also remodeled stores, storefronts, shopping centers, and did the branding.
So also tell us how you got connected with Lebesnik then.
Well, it's one of those places that I never really visited when I was living here. And I met Janet Block, the executive director, through my participation with the Michigan City Main Street Association at various events. And we just hit it off. And after I went to see what they do, I just fell in love with their mission and what they're doing with the community. So I started volunteering and doing various things at their events and for the gala. And eventually I became a board member, which I still am.
So tell us about the gift shop itself. What is there? What people can find there? Maybe some of the artists that you have there.
Absolutely. Well, we do focus on bringing in local and regional artists, and we have some long-term favorites, and we're bringing in new artists all the time. These are consigning artists, and, you know...
What percentage does the gallery take?
Yeah, the consignment arrangement is 60% goes to the artist and 40% to the art center.
Thank you.
And some of the artists that we have are, who do you have there?
Well, we have some really great classics that have been with us for a long time and are very good sellers. One of them is Annika Decker. Her company is Anko. And as she likes to say, she is Dutch by origin, African by osmosis, and American by assimilation. She draws her inspiration for her jewelry collection from having lived in Africa and from traveling all over the world. And what's really cool about her necklaces and jewelry is that she uses all kinds of natural materials such as stone, wood, bone, glass, leather, suede, and it kind of has a tribal feel. So Annika is one of our favorites. Also, we have, we're actually just now bringing in is Rita Cochran, and she's out of Union Pier, and she does these really lovely like reinvented and repurposed cashmere scarves and skirts and really great little hats that kind of have a pillbox kind of tone to them, so kind of retro. So we're excited about having her. Another one of our favorites is Lynn Tan. She is a porcelain artist, and she's out of Stevensville, Michigan. And she does really thoughtful housewares in porcelain and also makes really beautiful and delicate looking jewelry. And even though it looks delicate and very organic in form, it's very durable. So that's pretty cool. More recently, some new artists are... the following. We have Marco Flaseri. He is a Sheridan Beach resident here in Michigan City. And he's a ceramicist that is inspired by marine biology and otherworldly type things. It's really very cool. And he has various sized vessels, including very small ones that are very affordable, that are like air plant pots. And so he's brand new, and he actually was exhibiting at the Lubeznik Art Festival and was awarded for, like, I think it was best in or new artist participating.
Well, that was well deserved.
Yeah, his work is really creative, really beautiful.
Rose, you have something coming up pretty soon, and you know we want to make sure we get to that. The Holiday Bazaar. So tell us when that starts and what exactly that's what's going to happen with that.
Okay, well, our annual Holiday Bazaar begins November 20th, and unlike other holiday markets in the area, ours actually runs until January 9th, so you can definitely get gifts up to the very last minute without having to worry about shipping delays. And the market will be open during our regular business hours. So on Saturday and Sunday, we're open from 11 to 4, and then Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Thursday, and Friday, we're open from 11 to 5 p.m.
And how can people reach you, either by email or phone?
Well, anyone can email me at my Lubeznik email, which is rtejeda@lubeznikcenter.org. Or I can be reached at the Arts Center itself, which is 219-874-4900. Extension 200.
Well, that's great. So that's coming up. You open up very soon here on the Holiday Artisan Market, November 20th at Lubeznik, running through January 9th. That's Rose Tejeda, Gallery Gift Shop Manager. Thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you. My pleasure.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
We'd like to welcome to Art in the Air from the Indiana Arts Commission. She was just named the executive director for the Indiana Arts Commission. She has a career that spans from Bloomington all through that. And we just want to find out a little bit about her as she just came into office on, the 19th. So please welcome to Art in the Air, Maya Michelson. Welcome to our show.
Welcome.
Hi.
Aloha.
Thanks, Larry and Esther. It's great to be here.
Great to be here. And we have to say, just by way of disclosure, that we are supported by the Indiana Arts Commission through WVLP. So we are, through them, a grant, considering even though our show is heard on also Lakeshore Public Radio. So what we want to know in our show, and we always like our guests to tell us a little bit about their history, how you got from where you were to where you are. So tell us a little about your history, where you went to school, where you grew up, some of the things you did in Bloomington, and how you got to the IAC.
Sure. So I am not a native Midwesterner. I was born and raised in Arkansas. of all places. And so a Southerner actually by birth. I've managed to sort of work that dialect out of my speech since then. I was a theater major, and that sort of helped sort of knock some of that out of me. But yeah, grew up in Arkansas, went to a small college in Arkansas and majored in theater. And right after I graduated from college, started auditioning, did shows, and actually met my husband backstage. Or we were both in a cast of a production, and that's how we met, literally backstage. And
so sweet.
Yeah. So I met my husband backstage, and it was one of those good backstage love stories. And then we did some acting, some gig work in other places, did summer stock. And he had come from an academic family and was interested in getting involved in or getting into academia. And so he applied for his first gig, his first job, and it was at Stevens College in Columbia, Missouri. Then from there, we went to University of Southern Mississippi in Hattiesburg. And then we were 15 years in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, at the University of Alabama. And all through that time, I was performing, but then I was also getting deeper into arts administration. And I realized that what I really loved was, I loved the performing, but what I really, really loved was the role of an arts administrator in facilitating other people's arts experiences, whether that was the performers or whether that was the audience or the community. And so I realized that was really the thing that I loved most.
So what did you do? So you're acting, and then how did you get into the, what was your first thing that put you into administration?
You know, it was box office. It was work in the box office. And I happened to, a couple of my first box office gigs were at theaters that were routinely selling out. So it was always that drama and jazz of, you know, can we get everybody in and, you know, get everybody in on the waiting list, and can we set up folding chairs? I mean, it just got to be sort of exciting every night. It was like, you know, people lined up and ready again. So I was like, oh, I love this. This is really fun. This is a big puzzle. And I love sort of, and I love the fact that people are lined up to get in to see these shows, to see these arts performances. It was like, I've got to do everything I can, no matter what, to get people in. So that was what really flipped the switch for me. And then I moved from box office to general manager positions, and then eventually to executive director positions. I worked at a arts center and did a big arts festival and art studio complex, then worked at a theater company, worked as an executive director for a children's museum, which was a fantastic gig. I have two sons. My kids were pretty little at the time, and they thought the fact that their mom ran a children's museum was just the greatest thing going. So that was really fun. And then we moved to Bloomington, Indiana. My husband had the opportunity to become chair of the theater department at IU. And we relocated from Tuscaloosa, Alabama to Bloomington, Indiana, which is a pretty big culture shift to go. From there, a Southeastern Conference football giant to a place that maybe you knew that there was a football game in town and maybe you didn't. So it was a really totally different environment. But what was great about it, what was amazing about Bloomington, and it's still amazing about Bloomington, and Esther and you and I were talking a little bit about this before we flipped the mics on, was just the strong culture of arts and artists in that part of the state. Your neck of the woods has that as well. And what's one of the great things about this opportunity here at the Arts Commission is that we're able to dig in and see communities and see the great culture of arts and organizations that are in each region of the state that are unique. And
it's so true.
Yep.
It's so true. And that's where the wonderful IAC brings sort of everybody together, because I spent time in New Albany.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's so eye-opening how vibrant the state is. And because we're in our Northwest Indiana, and our proximity to Chicago affords us a lot of talent that comes this way, of course, but to see what the rest of the state is doing, it's phenomenal.
I want to go back to
go ahead, Larry. Sorry.
I wanted to go back though to some of your performing. So what roles did you perform and things like that?
Yeah. So I did. I was in Black Coffee, which was Agatha Christie's very first play that she ever wrote. Not her best, by the way. But I have, oddly enough, I'm one of those people that is in these sort of obscure shows like more than once. I was in Black Coffee twice, oddly enough. And actually, Black Coffee is the show that I met my husband in. But it's, again, a classic Agatha Christie whodunit mystery. And then I was in The Boyfriend. The musical, The Boyfriend, was in that show twice. Again, that's a musical. That's one of those little tiny jewel box musicals that people isn't done much anymore, but was in that twice. Gosh, was in Guys and Dolls, Steel Magnolias, Anything Goes, Tartuffe. Trying to think now, I'm going way, way back in the Wayback Machine. Oklahoma, just sort of the standards, and a couple of new plays as well. So, and when I say I was in musicals, I can't say that I have a great musical theater voice, but I made up for it with just being really loud.
So, the theatrical belt. Yes.
That comes in handy just in general.
But I do love musicals. In fact, my youngest son was over the other night, and we were just talking about musicals, and because he did show choir in high school and kind of got bit by that bug when he was in high school, and we were just talking about just musicals and the shows that he loved and the shows that we loved, and we were actually playing a game which we do sometimes, which is cast your perfect, what's your perfect show, and then cast it with all, with performers that you like, from different generations and things like that. And sometimes we do things like that. And although both of my sons are engineers now, my oldest one graduated from Purdue with a degree in mechanical engineering, and my youngest one's about to graduate from IU with a degree in engineering, I'm happy to say that they're, even though they're not performers, they both love the arts. And so, as I say to them, I said, don't feel bad, because the world needs plenty of arts patrons as well as artists as well. So I'm just glad that I've got two kids that like going to museums, that love going to live performance and love theater. And that's.
Well, there's an arts and mechanical engineering as well.
Yes, you got it. And there's, creative thinking. I mean, one of the
Problem solving.
Absolutely. One of the things we're talking about here at the Arts Commission that the state's talking about writ large is, the idea of creative thinking and the idea of creativity in the workforce and people who bring the ability to think creatively and collaboratively, which theater, talk about a collaborative art, theater is sort of the penultimate. I mean, orchestral and live music is certainly that as well, but there's something about theater that's collaborative in a way that I think most other art forms aren't, or a lot of other art forms aren't. So I think that's
well, it brings the family. I mean, like theater becomes a family for that short amount of time.
Yeah, absolutely. Like a community. Absolutely.
I know my wife and I met in a similar circumstance to yours, and we always called, and our daughter was involved in theater. So we always said that, theater is the family business. So let's move on to your time in Bloomington. So you landed in Bloomington and the new culture of the Southern Indiana. So tell us about that.
Yeah. So started in Bloomington as the gallery director of the Bloomington Area Arts Council. Then in about a year and a half was promoted to executive director of the Arts Council. And we were actually a regional partner for the Arts Commission. And that's when I first got to know the Arts Commission and some of the staff and sort of what they did and became aware. I had been a grants writer in previous iterations and other organizations in other states and got to know those state arts commissions well and got to know the folks at the IAC and thought, well, this is, I like the vibe. I like, I like kind of how they approach and think about things. And it's just an interesting state arts agency. And so after being at the Arts Council for about a year and a half, the mayor of Bloomington at the time, Mark Krizan, was forming an arts and entertainment district, the Bloomington Arts and Entertainment and Arts District, in downtown Bloomington, and he was looking for someone to head that up, to be on the city staff, to be in the Department of Economic Development. And it was a new position. It was a new kind of position. Usually in municipal governments, the art staffer might be in the Parks Department, or they might be in a Department of Cultural Affairs, or I've sometimes seen them in planning, or sometimes they're in the office of the mayor. But this was the first one I'd seen that was in an economic development department. I thought, this is interesting. Perfect. Because Bloomington's economy is so focused around not only IU, but the arts and entertainment industries and artists and organizations that are there. So it was a recognition of that. And it was developing a position that really had thinking about arts and the economy of a city sort of front and center. And that was just too good of an opportunity to resist. And so went over to work for the city for 8 years, which was an amazing experience. Collaborated with a lot of departments in the city. We did public art. I developed grant programs. We did small business entrepreneurship programs for individual artists. I mean, it was a great opportunity to sort of see if you had plenty of running room, what you could do in city government when you really had someone who was devoted to thinking about not just the arts, which of course we know is critical and really important, but how you can plug in arts in other departments of the city. And that was one of the great benefits. I learned a lot about city government.
Yes.
A lot about city government. And I will tell you, you know, when I hear about other communities having challenges with all sorts of city services right now during the pandemic, it gives me such an appreciation to know how hard every one of those city governments is working to bring services to their city, because I got to see it sort of behind the scenes. And so city government folks are really a dedicated group of public servants, and I gained a great deal of admiration for them. And so after about 8 years at the city, Louis Rickey, who was the executive director at the time, called me up and said, look, we've got deputy director position here. What do you think? maybe think about applying. So I did, and came up here as deputy director and was deputy director for about 6 years. And then he announced his retirement, and I applied for the job and went through a rigorous, and I mean rigorous, interview schedule. They put me through my paces, 5 interviews. So they took it very, very seriously. They had a great selection search committee from all over the state and all over the country that did the vetting, which was great. And
yeah, it is, because I mean, Louis was there for 15 years.
Yeah.
Right. It's like it's a longevity position. So,
right. It's it's a statewide position, right? So
right.
You've got to make sure that you've got someone in place who can keep that statewide perspective front and center. And it's something that I've thought a lot about. I've certainly thought a lot about when I was deputy director, and think a lot about now as executive director, which is I bring sort of where I'm from, you know, to my work. But again, I'm not working just for the city of Bloomington, right? I'm working for everyone. And so that's where the staff is so important. They bring input and thoughts and relationships from theirs. Communities or neighborhoods that they come from. And then we have commissioners. We have 15 commissioners from around the state, and they also bring their perspective from their where they live. And we've got 2 commissioners that are from your neck of the woods, and they bring that perspective. And we try, at least pre-pandemic, we were on the road quite a bit. We're kind of getting back to that now. But having meetings in different parts of the state, getting a flavor of what's special about those places, and getting those communities to show off what makes that particular part of the state really special. And that's a real joy of this work, for sure, knowing that we've got a statewide impact, and that we're so diverse and so unique, and that we take strength from that uniqueness, right? And what we're hoping to do here is build a culture of empowerment for the organizations and artists that we support, is that we take the communities that we're in, and we're informed by them, and we're strengthened by them, and they're strengthened by us. And so we're talking a lot about artists and organizations working in concert with communities so that we can really serve the places that we are around the state. So that's sort of the through line that I'm picking up from Lewis's tenure. We have lots of other things that we're thinking about and talking about right now.
Well, throughout the pandemic, you really kept everybody engaged during that. There were wonderful online seminars and talks, and they were consistent. It wasn't just like one here. I mean, it was like dedicated programming to keep everybody involved with each other and to offer resources. So I very much appreciated it. I was in the audience for most of them.
Well, thanks, Esther. That's one of the things that we were thinking about as an agency. What is it that we can uniquely do that no one else can do? And one of the things that we could do was try to pull resources and information together and share them with the field. And we were obviously really fortunate that there was federal funding that came from the National Endowment for the Arts, which is our federal funding partner that helped support organizations. Two rounds, actually three rounds, when you consider the fact that the governor's office so generously provided us an additional $10 million to administer with the Destination Development Corporation, which is tourism here at the state. So we were able to support all kinds of organizations, big and small, that we with frankly more money than we had ever been able to give out, which was amazing. And so we are very much in the debt of the governor's office for providing that funding for us. But yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the unique things that the state agency can do, which is to amplify resources and amplify voices and amplify connections with federal, in this case, federal relief programs that were out there. We also did the same for artists. You know, there was the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program, which covered gig workers for the first time. And so there was a lot of education that we needed to do for individual artists about how to access. There was a lot of handholding that we did for individual artists, as well as for organizations, about how to access some of this funding. The Small Business Administration, the Federal Small Business Administration, launched a program with a horrible name called the Shuttered Venues Operators Grant Program. Not a great name, but they certainly put out a lot of funds to help support both for-profit and not-for-profit venues and movie theaters and performing arts organizations, again, both for-profit and not-for-profit, to help keep them going, right? And so we were able to help provide some one-on-one counsel and some information for those organizations that we felt like ought to take a look. And there were several instances where we reached out directly to organizations and said, I don't see you on the funding list. You need to be thinking hard about this. And here's what you need to sort of get in place. And then getting them in touch with people that could kind of help counsel them through the process. That's what we at state government can do. Well, and I think to your point, Esther, you know, we had the same sort of weeks of panic as everyone else did once the pandemic hit, which was, oh my gosh, how can we help? You know, what can we do?
What can we do?
Right.
Yeah. What can we do? We know we've got to do something. We want to do something. What can we do? And so we quickly came together and said, we need to be a source of information and frankly, for comfort and solace and a listening ear and
and the side benefit was, again, artists got to meet even virtually in this way. So over the state, which I, you know, that was great when we broke out into side groups and stuff. That's when we were in a really wide variety of people from all over.
Yeah.
You know, we're getting to the end here and we have a couple of minutes left, but I want you to talk a little bit about, you've just been in the director's chair for a couple of weeks, but, you know, what do you see? What do you see for some of the plans that you might want to implement?
Yeah, great. Great question, Larry. We are about at the end of our strategic plan. We do a 5-year strategic plan. So we're about at the end of that. So what comes next for us? So that's a big question we'll be thinking about. I say that recognizing that we don't know what the post-pandemic world is going to look like for the arts. We're watching very carefully trends in attendance at live performance and museums and so forth to try to get some sense of what audiences are going to do and what organizations are going to want to do and what communities are going to be asking them to do and what artists want to do, right? So we're seeing tangentially, I'm sure you've heard it discussed, we're seeing evidence of the big quit or the great resignation of 2021. And what we're seeing is the beginnings of people who say, you know, I always wanted to have that woodworking business. I'm going to quit my job as a, you know, blank car salesman, and I'm going to start a woodworking business. So we're beginning to see the green shoots of people saying, I'm going to finally do this thing. So how do we respond to all of that? And I think what we're thinking about right now is, how can we be paying attention to the trends and the behaviors that are out there and sort of be planning alongside them so that we're ready once we're sort of got a better sense of what the world's going to look like, so that we're ready to meet that, whatever it might be. But I would be presumptuous for me to say that, you know, I have any idea what the economy and the arts environment is going to look like in 6 months. I think we're still really paying attention to that and just trying to be here with the resources and the sounding board and the listening ear and the information that artists and arts organizations need. So we're going along on the journey. So that's
very good. Well, let's just give us our contact information, how people can reach the Indiana Arts Commission. You and also just real briefly in the last moments here we have.
Sure. Our website is in.gov/arts. We have a lot of newsletters and they are fantastic. So a great way to stay connected with us is to subscribe to all our newsletters. We have one for artists. We have one for communities. We have one for organizations. So subscribe to that. You can email me directly at michaelsen@iec.in.gov. And you can call me directly. And I have it written down because it's a new phone number. Otherwise, I'll forget it. You can call me directly and I will answer the phone at 317-903-6728. Call me. If you've got ideas, concerns, thoughts, we want to hear it. So be on the lookout for us to be in your neck of the woods soon and asking you what you'd like the Arts Commission to do for you and your community.
Well, we'd like to thank you for being on Art in the Air. That's Maya Michelson from the Indiana Arts Commission, newly appointed executive director, though she's been there for a while. Thank you so much for being on Art on the Air.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Maya.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
And we'd like to welcome to this edition of Art in the Air. The Landmark Columbus Foundation cares for and celebrates and advances the cultural heritage of Columbus, Indiana. It's a community resource. It's thought of as a leader of progressive preservation in the entire county. And to fulfill its mission, they have three engaged, globally connected programs. We'd like to welcome the executive director to Art in the Air, Richard McCoy. Richard, welcome to Art in the Air.
Aloha, Richard.
Thank you.
Well, Richard, we'd like to ask you kind of about your personal journey first. We always like to phrase it like how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us a little bit about yourself first.
Well, thanks. I thought I wanted to be an airline mechanic when I was an undergraduate. And I was studying aviation technology at Purdue University in a pretty part-time way. I've never been a good academic, but I thought it was fascinating to work on things that fly. And just the whole idea and principle of humans being able to get things in the air. And I've always liked to do things with my hand and my mind. And I thought it was a great opportunity to become a mechanic for an airline and to fix jets. And that lasted the better part of 6 months. And then I realized that wasn't for me. And I eventually moved to Indiana University, where I got an undergraduate degree in journalism and political science with a minor in Spanish. And the Spanish minor is super important because in many ways, it was my ticket out of Indiana. When I finished IU, I thought I would leave the state with my wife and never return. You know, I was looking for something more. I was looking for a place that maybe had a greater sense of creativity and exploration. I think in high school or undergrad, there's always that feeling of being stuck a little bit and being in, you know, surrounded by places that are doing more. And so I had a Fulbright scholarship to go to Madrid, Spain, where I lived for a year with my wife. And we traveled around Europe some, and it really opened my eyes to the idea of living in a city. And from there, we moved to New York City, where I got a graduate degree from New York University in art history and the conservation and restoration of three-dimensional objects. And I was able to, while there, my wife and I were able to have two children, and it shifted our ideas, and we decided we should move back to the Midwest. And we looked at Chicago, Detroit, and Indianapolis, and we thought, well, if we're going to move back, we might as well move to the center of it all. And so I eventually found a position at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, working in the conservation and restoration department there and working on exhibitions and contemporary art. And that lasted for 10 years. And since this is an art show, I'd say just directly, you know, I worked with three or four directors, but the last one changed the vision of the organization. And a bunch of us found ourselves on the other side of that vision. And it caused me to rethink what I wanted to do. And I had this amazing opportunity presented by the mayor of Columbus, the former mayor of Columbus, to work in Columbus and to create a strategy to care for and celebrate and advance what has made Columbus such an amazing place. And I've been doing that since 2013. And it's a remarkable opportunity to work with really special people. And it's kind of become a different kind of airplane to work on, if you will. It is a way to work on something that, you know, has a story that carries us beyond Indiana and carries us into the national spotlight and allows us to show how cities in Indiana, there's a number of them that are remarkable and that do deserve national attention, not for the sake of national attention, but because the quality of life is so good there that it's worth living in Indiana in certain places. So that's a long, circuitous way around how I got to where I'm at. And I don't know, I probably left some things out.
One thing I'd like to ask is with Air Mechanic Vision, did you ever want to be a pilot?
I would have loved to, but it was always too expensive. You know, I came from modest means and paid for all of my undergraduate myself. And it was just so expensive to be a pilot. But I would fly sometimes with pilots that were in the program. We would just go up on a weekend and fly around, and I loved it. And I still love flying. It's a magical thing that we can sit in a seat and fly 500 miles an hour over the country. It's amazing.
Yeah, I'm a pilot, so that's why I know that. So it is a very mad. And of course, living in Northwest Indiana, and I haven't flown recently, but I just need to go and do that. Flying through Chicago is just marvelous. I mean, it's just going by. It's that's the thing. So, but let's get back to that. So tell us a little bit about the foundation.
How it came together and how, yes.
Well, thanks. So, so I started working there in 2013, and you know, the community was going through some pretty major upheavals. And I'll just take a quick second to explain what Columbus is. It's a town of 55,000 people. It's the global headquarters for Cummins, which makes diesel engines and now engines of a number of varieties. And it's a town that in post-war America really boomed because it was making diesel engines. And that's what modern America needed to run the highways and to run the ships. And so Cummins Diesel Engines and other corporations and leaders there really had a different way to think about a corporation's relationship to a community. And they themselves invested in the community through the built environment and many other ways. But Columbus is most famous for these investments in the built environment. Churches, schools, libraries, parks, city hall, all these buildings that create the greatest benefit are some of those where the community has worked the hardest and thought the longest about. And it's created this amazing place that has this collection of about 100 significant things. And I mean things, you know, buildings, landscapes, and public artwork and other stuff. And, you know, the protagonist for this story in the first part of the 20th century was waning. It was the Miller family, and in some cases, the Baker family. And these families were sort of transitioning out of their leadership roles. And ultimately, the Miller family and the Baker families passed on. And the community was sort of asking itself, what do we do with this amazing story, this amazing collection of cultural heritage? How do we take care of it? And are we done? Or, you know, was that it? And there was a kind of movement within the community that says, we're not done. And we want to create a unique way to care for this cultural heritage. And this is what I had the opportunity to be involved with. And so,
Richard, who does that conversation, well, who is that conversation with? Like, what part of the community comes together? Because I always wonder where business, there's the team of people who, you know, have these creative ideas. And then when do you include, is business and community involved in those discussions initially?
That's a great question. It started out with a conversation with the former mayor and some folks in the community development department, but that didn't last that long. Those conversations lasted about 11 months or so. And then we moved the conversation over to the Community Foundation. And in Indianapolis, community foundations are really the heart of many cities. And they're the place where major stakeholders gather, business leaders, community leaders, education leaders, political leaders, and they think about the future. And those sometimes those board of directors are really the kind of brains in the bank of town. And they from a high level, really set a number of trajectories. And I took a gamble with that board of directors one day and challenged them and said, Columbus wasn't as audacious as it used to be. And we need to get back to doing really cool things. And it was a gamble on my part. No one on the board knew it was coming. And it was a make it or break it moment for me. And as it turns out, the board sort of looked around and shook their head and agreed. And we got busy with an audacious plan to build what is today Landmark Columbus Foundation. And it's an organization that has some of those leaders on its board of directors. You know, we purposely built a board that is really actively engaged in the community in leadership roles. And so, you know, we're communicating today with the mayor, major business leaders, the head of the community foundation, religious leaders, educational leaders. You know, the cultural heritage of Columbus matters a lot to a wide number of people.
And what I particularly, because I did spend a day in Columbus going through the exhibit, and it's a day I'll never forget. I mean, because the taboo, there's such a taboo of touching and institutions, you know, and galleries, and they need to impose that for conservation reasons, but it leaves you at sometimes a distance. And so things have dramatically shifted when an attraction, you're able to interact with it, and it's doubled when you have the, you know, when you actually have the invitation to interact with it. And that's how I felt in Columbus. It was a very physical, you can interact very physically with most of those art installations. And the whole community is involved in that, you know, and that was exciting too, because I found myself actually taking pictures in the installations and walking on them and climbing on them, and the anticipation of going to the next one was there. So that's quite an important thing that you've given to the community. It was, and the community, like, as we were walking the streets, it felt like family, which was so interesting. You know, it was nighttime and most of the businesses were closed, but you have people out there still interacting with those installations. It's quite phenomenal.
Well, thank you. That's really inspiring to hear, to know that some of those intentions came through and that you had a great time and it felt good. You know, that's ultimately, you know, that's a big part of it. Does it feel right? But let me just explain a little bit, Esther, what Exhibit Columbus is, because it's a little different than it's a lot different than what a museum is. But, you know, we wanted to create a way to explore what Columbus is all about, in a sense, reinvigorate some of these things downtown that maybe people had forgotten about. As I mentioned, there was a kind of decline in the early 2000s. And so we created this program that is a cycle of events that has that starts with thinking about ideas in a symposium, inviting artists and architects to come to town to think with us, to look at a place where they might create something. And then we give them, through our fundraising, a cash build award where they start to dream of what they can build in our community for a temporary installation. So they think about that. They come up with an idea. They present it back to our community and say, this is what I want to build. And then they get the cash and they build it in some case, or a lot of cases, with folks in Columbus or in Indianapolis or around the state and the country. And we build these temporary installations the following year. So we're in our third cycle of this. We just opened our third exhibition in August, and it runs through the end of this year, end of November. And so these installations, this idea to get to walk through a town and see things that maybe are a little more in-depth than a piece of public art, a little more thoughtful than, you know, quote, placemaking, and but connected to notions of preservation. We want you to come out and to explore and think about downtown. And so I love it. I think that Exhibit Columbus, by having a symposium and an exhibition and doing exactly what you're talking about, put things on the street and asking people to think about them, to interact with them, it's totally different than what a museum does. I think in many cases,
right.
Museums are at a critical point. How do they connect with their community when they're often behind gated walls? It's a challenge and we don't have any of that.
It's financially inaccessible for most families at this point. You know, we understand how the fees need to go up because of their exploration that they need to do around the world and their acquisitions, but that you lose a major part of the population seeing and enjoying art in public. That's where public art is profound and vital and crucial. And I really like with the Columbus exhibit, though, the impermanence of it is very special as well. Except sometimes you go, oh, I want to see this forever. So do you like, I don't want this to go away. This is so fabulous. But you know that the next round will be fabulous as well. So how do you have a plan? Are you also working on permanent installations within Columbus as well as the impermanent?
Well, if I could take a minute before I get to that question, you brought up something really interesting, just this idea of how do we create challenging and compelling contemporary art and architecture that's accessible to people? And I was listening to John and Sarah Green at their 2021 Indiana Arts Commission keynote address, and they were talking about this idea, if you know John and Sarah, they're actively involved in literature and the arts, and they're always talking about very complex ideas, but they break it down in a way that people can understand it. And I was so inspired by that, you know, is that one of the things that they really work on is they acknowledge their perspective. And then as they're both writers, they really lean on a sense of a narrative, and they, try to not shy away from presenting complex ideas, but do it in a way that brings as many people along as possible. And you just don't see museums working in that way. But that's really this struggle that, well, you don't see many, right? There are some. But, you know, this is this question that we continue to struggle with, is how do we make these things compelling and thoughtful about hundreds of years of history? And, you know, we try to do it through a narrative, try to do it through stories. And it's something that is, you know, Esther, as you point out, like pushing us to this idea of permanence or greater impact, I would say. I don't know if we're 100% ready to think about permanence, but when you're working in the community and you're seeing things changing people's lives, and so it's even just to hear you say today, I had such a great time. That I remember that. It in a small way, changed your life. And once you start to understand your work is having that kind of impact, you know, it becomes addictive. Well, how do I create more of that? How do I get more Esters to Columbus to change their life? How do I do these things? And so that's what we're focused on. And that could include permanence.
Richard, there's three components to your organization. There's the Landmark Columbus, and we've talked about Exhibit Columbus, and also the Columbus Design Institute. Kind of compare what each one of them do within the context of your operation.
Well, thanks. And so the organization started with a number of really smart people in Columbus and Indianapolis, a professor, Kelly Wilson, a professor at Ball State University, Janice Shimizu, a designer in Columbus, Jonathan Neshi, a graphic designer, an art producer, and Ann Surak. And we kind of came up with two initial streams. One is a group that was working on Exhibit Columbus, and that's a lot of work. And but then my part of it has always been the preservation aspect of it, and that's Landmark Columbus. And so through Landmark Columbus, we do a lot of preservation projects and events. We're currently working to help a church downtown raise $2.4 million to rebuild the upper part of its iconic tower. We're helping another church on the north side of town. We just helped this small business move it, adaptively reuse a coffee shop built by a world famous architect. So we're doing stuff that really cares for heritage while celebrating it. And Exhibit Columbus kind of advances it. But, you know, last year or the year before, we created this third area, Columbus Design Institute, in a sense, out of opportunity. We have a great network and a great process that we use. And people started to seek us out to say, hey, can you help us run a design competition? Can you help us put on these series of events to think about art and culture? Can you help us think about public art or things in the public realm? And so we've been doing that, you know, for a few years. And it's a really rewarding way to expand our network, but also earn revenue for our organization. As you can imagine, running a nonprofit, it's a constant churn of raising money to do your work. And to have another source of revenue is pretty awesome.
You actually have a central location that people can come to. Tell us briefly about, you know, how people could find that and what to expect if I was coming to visit, like Esther had visited. Kind of paint the picture for our radio audience.
Well, thanks. So, you know, in Columbus, there's a lot of collaboration. There's a lot of working together. And one of our best partners is the Columbus Area Visitor Center. And so that's on the corner of 5th and Franklin. And so we actually encourage people to start at the visitor center to get to know us and to get to know the community. And, you know, we actually also work with a lot of small merchants downtown. I encourage you to go to Viewpoint Books on the corner of 6th and Washington, or to go down on the 400 block of Washington and see Baker's Fine Gifts and Accessories, or Dell Brothers, the state's oldest men's store. So actually, one of the great ways to get to know us is to go shopping in Columbus.
Yeah.
But if you want to contact us directly, I think going to our webpage, landmarkcolumbusfoundation.org, is an awesome way to learn about what we do. And, you know, I love communicating with people. I, you know, welcome people to send me an email personally and tell me they're coming. And, you know, and I'll try to put together an experience like Esther had. My email is richard@landmarkcolumbus.org.
Excellent. So Columbus is situated like in mid-southern Indiana. And how did that become the focal point of all this? I mean, why not somewhere else in Indiana? Is it because it's driven by you coming there and kind of making this happen or along with the community?
No, it's not driven by me. I mean, you know, Columbus and Indiana are places that have had human civilization for tens of thousands of years. And this is a place in Indiana that's the intersection of two rivers. And so there have been humans there for many years, the Adena and Hopewell, in the early, 2,000 years ago. And then later in the 18th century, we know that Miami and Kickapoo and Weehaw nations were there, and then later the Delaware. And so it's always been a place where humans have gathered. And we try to think about that and recognize that those cultures are still alive and vibrant today. Their languages are vibrant and we celebrate them. But as a European city, Columbus was founded actually 200 years ago this year, 1821. But it was a sort of normal city until the first rail line went into the state in the 1840s. And from there, a number of manufacturing companies really blossomed. And so it's a place that's unlike a college town. If you think about Purdue or West Lafayette or Notre Dame or Muncie, you know, there it's a different vibe. Columbus is a hardworking kind of industrial town where there's a lot of very smart people that get up early and get going. I feel like there's more that happens in Columbus by 9 a.m. than college towns by 2. So
they like to be up at the crack of noon in those college towns.
That's right. It's not a college town vibe. It's not uncommon to have a meeting at 7 or 7:30 in the morning.
So this might be too late in the conversation to ask this, but how do you find your artists? Do you put out calls? Yeah. Do you make calls? Do you?
We've done it in all sorts of ways, but left to our own devices, we like to work with experts and research and find out who we think is going to be the very best. And so we try for excellence in everything we do, because we ultimately think by getting the very best in the country or in the world, it is a point of aspiration. But we also work with a lot of local folks. And so it's trying to balance that one side and the other, is that how do you create things that are with and for a community while at the same time bringing them ideas that are totally new and unexpected. And so we do a little bit of research. We've done open calls, and we'll think about it again when we get set building the fourth cycle of Exhibit Columbus next year.
And so, Richard, initially, did you walk the town or drive the town to say this would be a good place, that would be a good place?
Oh, you got to walk it. You can't. I mean, in any city, you got to walk it. I'm a runner and a walker, and cities are, I get it, they're built for cars, but they're really best when understood at a human scale. And so we walk around, we try to understand the sites that would make the most sense and where we have the best partnerships to do things. And so we rely on collaborations and partnerships. And so it's very much a human interaction.
Richard, we just have a few moments left here. So tell us how we can find out about your place at Landmark Columbus Foundation and website, location, all that.
Great. Well, I'd love it if you guys would go to landmarkcolumbus.org. Scroll down and subscribe to our newsletter. That's a great way to keep in contact with us. We don't send a ton of them, but we'll tell you a little bit about what's going on in Columbus. And it comes from my email. And so you can respond to me and we can start a conversation. But we'd love it if you subscribe to our newsletter at our webpage, landmarkcolumbusfoundation.org, and scroll down to subscribe.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air. That's Richard McCoy, Executive Director of Landmark Columbus Foundation. We really appreciate you coming on Art on the Air and sharing about Columbus, Indiana.
Yeah, thank you, Richard.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Art on the Air, and we'd like to thank our guests this week on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard every Friday at 11 a.m. and rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP. Art on the Air streams live at WVLP.org, plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, WVLP Station Manager, and Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant and the National Endowment for the Arts. Underwriters for Art on the Air, Mary LeVan, Arts Patron. Art on the Air is always looking for financial support. We'd like to thank our current supporters. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA. You can find out support information there. So don't just be an Art on the Air listener. Become a supporter or underwriter in whatever amount you're able to do so we continue to bring you this great content and this great local programming. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. And you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. Show.